It's absolutely wonderful to be here as always, and to give a public lecture. I'm sorry I sound a little bit funny. I don't always sound so much like Kermit the Frog, but please bear with me. Well, David has set this talk up beautifully, so we can just jump right into it. I should say that most of this public lecture was thought about before the excitement that David alluded to, so the content is going to be somewhat different. We won't talk at all about dark energy. For people who are here to hear about dark energy, I apologize. Dark energy is wonderful, it's great, it's awesome, and I don't care about it at all right now. I'd be very happy to talk about it maybe next week, or but not tonight specifically. So I won't say any more about that. Oops, sorry about that. That's strange. Okay. So as David said, we are really entering an experimental data dominated period in fundamental physics. The LHC is really on, and there are a whole host of experiments in closely related areas, astrophysics and cosmology. There's been lots of recent excitement. There was lots of recent excitement to trigger having this workshop, and we're all coming here in anticipation of some very cool data to talk about that we'd pre-digested. We're going to discuss. And then 3 weeks ago, we got hammered with this news that on the second to last day of our workshop was going to be a rather interesting announcement by this experiment. So remember these initials, because if you care about science in this business in the next while, you'll be hearing them over and over again. The experiment is the cryogenic dark matter search. If, in fact, they have discovered dark matter, if it really holds up, it would be singularly appropriate. This experiment is the granddaddy of all dark matter detection experiments. And while there's a whole host of exciting ones coming up that I'm going to be telling you about, it would really be wonderful if they pulled it out in the end. But anyway, this is happening tomorrow. I guess I could have put one more exclamation mark, but I think we've hyped it appropriately. So what I want to talk about in the rest of the lecture is how we'll go about seeing something that's dark. So how are we going to see the dark matter? And I also want to put it a little bit broader context. That discovering this thing isn't, it would be wonderful to know if it's there and what its properties are in and of itself. But there is another layer. It could very well have some very significant implications for bigger picture, more fundamental questions in physics. And I want to talk a little bit about that. So in order to start by putting this thing in context, I'm going to have to abbreviate the last 60 years in the evolution of our subject on one transparency. Okay? This business got a big kickstart in the 50s when people built accelerators to smash particles into each other to probe smaller distances. So this is one of the remarkable large-scale consequences of quantum mechanics. If you want to study what's going on in nature at very short distances, you have to smash things into each other at very high energies. That's not obvious. You might have thought you could build a little Fantastic Voyage-type spaceship and just make it smaller and smaller and smaller. And if the world was a classical world, you could do that. But you can't in a quantum mechanical world. You really have to smash things into each other at very high energies to probe tiny distances. And people started doing that, probing distances at around 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. That's around the size of the proton. And what happened is they started producing just tons and tons of complicated particles, all sorts of interesting things. There was a period of tremendous confusion, a period of confusion that David and other people sorted out for us. But I can really summarize if I wanted to summarize in one sentence what happened. What happened is that the fundamental pillars of the revolutions of the first half of the 20th century, the revolutions of special relativity and quantum mechanics, were synthesized, and their synthesis was understood. The way to put them together was understood to be this remarkably deep and beautiful structure known as quantum field theory. Which had enough structure in it to be able to describe all the complicated things that were happening in a essentially unified, in an essentially unified way. And so we've been doing that for a long time. This basic synthesis has stayed unchanged. It's unlikely to change for a very long time. And in the intervening 60 years, we've gone down about a factor of 1,000 in distance. We're now about to probe distances that are around 1,000 times smaller than the proton, 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, by colliding these particles into each other at the LHC. And here we actually expect, there's lots of indirect reasons to expect, purely theoretically, purely from internal arguments of logical consistency, difficulties, theoretical difficulties with the structure that we've seen, that we should be seeing something. And the thing that we should be seeing shouldn't just be some random addition to what we have already, but should involve some essential new concepts. Very likely, that concept is going to involve some extension of our notions of space-time, the most natural one of which is likely this notion of supersymmetry. So this is a chain really given from the perspective of a theorist summarizing the last 60 years and where we might be going, completely, purely motivated from internal consistency, mathematical consistency, logical arguments. Okay? These are arguments that would appeal to a theorist. On the other hand, there have been arguments from the very, very end, and these are arguments about what's going on at the tiniest distances imaginable that we've been to. There have been arguments from exactly the opposite length scale of the universe, at the very, very largest distances, that there is also something missing. By now, there's lots and lots of evidence that most of the mass in the universe isn't the stuff you and I are made of, is ordinary atoms and molecules, but is something new, dark matter. And I'm just summarizing the very, very first, and in a sense, the most classic indication of this, that there had to be dark matter out there. So here's a picture of our galaxy where it's some random place, not too special. In it, and you can also look at many, many other galaxies. And in these galaxies, the stars are spinning around. Okay, and it's possible to indirectly figure out how fast they're spinning around. Okay, now just take a look at this picture. Clearly, there's more stars there, there's less stars there, and the stars start petering out, right? So you would expect that more or less most of the mass in the galaxy is contained in this little bulge here. Now, let's say you're a star out there. The only reason that you're being stuck to go around the center of the galaxy is because you're being attracted by the mass of all the stars that are further in. If you're a star that's further out, well, there isn't really much more mass attracting you in, and the overall force of gravity is getting weaker. There's the famous inverse square law. So you would expect that if you are nonetheless happily orbiting around, you had better be moving more slowly here than you are there. If you're moving as quickly here as you were there, well, you'd just escape. If here you were bound, here you'd just escape. Okay? So it's a very basic prediction. You look at that picture, most of the mass is in the center. So if you just if you measured the velocity of the stars orbiting the galaxy, as you go to larger and larger distances, you'd expect that velocity to go down. Very basic. Very, very basic prediction. Instead, what happened over and over again with people doing the measurements is they found that the velocity went to a constant, more or less, rather than going down. Okay. So now, what do you do when this happens? What do you do in science when there's a disagreement between between a well-established theory and experiment? This depends a little bit on your philosophy. Some people who believe more in experiments will say that at the first hint of anything wrong, the second an experiment disagrees with theory, you chuck the theory. You falsified it, and it's wrong. Okay? These people have never been right in the history of science. Okay? Good theories are really hard to come by, and you don't just toss them out at the drop of a hat. What you do instead is you try to interpret what you're seeing as a small modification on the theory that you have already. Okay? Not every disagreement between theory and experiment is a call to revolution. If we knew ahead of time when you needed a revolution and when you just needed to tweak what you had already, it would be great. We trained, you know, one kind of people, right? Revolutionary people or stick-in-the-mud people, and we just, you know, set them out to conquer the scientific landscape. You never know ahead of time, okay? The most prudent thing to do is to take the attitude that you tweak what you have to see if you can make it work. And you keep doing it until it becomes intolerable. If it becomes intolerable, then maybe a revolution is needed then. But there's certainly no cause to throw Newton out and Einstein out. And what you do instead is say, there must be some mass we're not seeing. Okay? There must be some mass we're not seeing that keeps this guy orbiting around with that constant velocity. You might say this sounds an awful lot like the ether. And, well, it can sound like it, but it's a perfectly reasonable explanation. And as we'll see, well, perhaps we're actually starting to see it directly. An indication that this is a good explanation is that every other kind of explanation that tries to be more radical falls flat on its face right away in 100 other ways. Whereas this is a perfectly reasonable thing. That, incidentally, this idea of dark stuff has worked many times before. Back in the 1800s, people saw tiny deviations in the orbit of faraway planets and used them to infer the existence of Neptune, and they got it right. So back then too, you could have said, "Oh, Newton's wrong," but no. You just add something. You do a small modification to what you have already. You add it, and it works. So back then, dark matter was dark planet, and it worked. That's actually a good. This is a nice parable for the statement I was telling you about the radical versus conservative in science, because the same thing happened with Mercury. People noticed something funny with the orbit of Mercury, and they tried to do the same thing. They invented a planet called Vulcan that went around the sun that was supposed to, you know, explain the little deviations in the orbit of Mercury. Some American astronomers even found Vulcan. But Vulcan was not there, and in that case, it really was a radical departure. That was due to general relativity. Anyway, so we never know ahead of time. But here, really, the most reasonable explanation seems to be that there is some extra dark stuff. Okay. So these are two hints, totally different hints. One coming from going to very, very short distances that we should see some exciting new things. I'm going to give you arguments for that now, more specific arguments about it. Purely internal theoretical hints. The other one is coming from cosmology, the very longest, biggest distances that we are missing something. The truly remarkable thing is that the two things seem to be related to each other. And that's what I want to explain in the next few minutes. So first, let me tell you what some of these hints are that we're missing something very, very big, and that what we're about to see at the LHC shouldn't just be some random addition to the standard picture of the world, but should be something more important. And it has to do with a very basic fact about nature that was revealed in the synthesis of quantum mechanics and relativity. One of the consequences of putting quantum mechanics and relativity together is the existence of antimatter. It would take me too long to explain. It's a very simple explanation. Anyone who's interested, I could tell you it would take 5 minutes. But antimatter must exist, and antimatter together with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle means that the vacuum is an exciting place. Why? Let me take my magnifying glass. I'm sorry, I'm such a terrible artist. That's my magnifying glass. Okay, and I'm going to use my magnifying glass to check that some region of space is empty. It's a vacuum. I'm going to check that it's empty. Well, the act of checking that it's empty by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, if I'm checking a small region. If I'm checking that a smaller and smaller region is empty, I have to put more and more energy into the region that I'm looking at. That's a consequence of the uncertainty principle. And because there's matter and antimatter, at some point I put so much energy into that region that I pop out an electron and its anti-electron. This conserves charge. It even conserves energy, given the uncertainty in the energy that went into the observation that I was doing. So in trying to verify that the vacuum was empty, I discover that, oh, shoot, there's an electron and a positron coming out. In fact, that means that if you had some very quiescent picture of a poor electron sitting there in space with its electric field lines going out forever but nothing else going on, which is the classical picture of this rather inert little object. In a quantum mechanical picture of the world, that's really not true. You should think of it as being surrounded constantly with a cloud of virtual particles popping in and out of the vacuum at all times. And if you do an experiment to try to probe what's going on at short distances, you will pop this stuff out. Now, Often people describe these gigantic accelerators like the LHC as nature's most powerful microscopes. But you can ask, what are they looking at? It's not like a piece of hair or something, right? What they're the microscopes of, they're the most powerful microscopes of the vacuum. Okay, so what we're doing with these gigantic accelerators is actually looking at the vacuum at the tiniest distances in order to see what's going on. Why do we look at the vacuum? We're interested in the fundamental laws of nature. And, well, they manifest themselves most cleanly when they're not being polluted by a lot of other junk lying around. We want to study what's going on in the vacuum. So the vacuum is exciting. This is a big deal. David won a Nobel Prize for this reason. But in fact, the vacuum is too exciting. So let me explain what I mean by this. Again, it goes constantly back to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and the existence of matter and antimatter over and over again. So let's say I take some box in space, this box. Okay? The uncertainty principle tells me that I should have some uncertainty in the energies and momenta in that box. So there are some sort of fluctuations in energy and momentum in this box. Let's say I make the box smaller. Well, the fluctuations are bigger. Make the box smaller still, the fluctuations get bigger and bigger. In fact, quantum mechanics really predicts that there is incredibly violent quantum fluctuations in the vacuum, which are bigger and bigger the smaller and smaller distance you go to. That's a basic prediction of this picture of the world, putting together quantum mechanics and relativity. Okay? It's not some detailed prediction in the sixth decimal place of some calculation. It's a zeroth order prediction of this unification of special relativity and quantum mechanics. But this gives rise to an immediate and very startling problem. How come there's a macroscopic universe then? How come the universe there looks the same as there, looks the same as there, looks the same as there? There are gigantic quantum fluctuations all over the place. How is there any order at all? How come there's a macroscopic universe? A particle moving along would just keep bumping into these violent fluctuations all the time. This is not quite precise what I'm saying, but it'll suffice for our purposes here. It should pick up a mass from a big mass from all these things that it's banging into all the time. But particles aren't that terribly massive. They're certainly not as massive as you would expect from these gigantic fluctuations that dominate things at the very shortest distances. So this is a big question, a very big question. What is it that tames these very violent quantum fluctuations in the vacuum? And what this question is about is a very, very zeroth order thing about the world. How come there is a big world? How come there's a macroscopic world when the laws are quantum mechanical and involve violent quantum fluctuations at the shortest possible distances? So that's a really major question. And there's lots of arguments that whatever the answer to this question is, whether it is or not what I'm about to tell you, at least whatever a big part of the answer to this question is must show up at the LHC. In other words, the LHC isn't exciting simply because it happens to be the frontier of where we're at. Completely independently, this question needs to have a solution at the distances that we're about to probe. Now, it stands to reason that because this problem is so basically tied in to putting together relativity and quantum mechanics, you put together a picture of space-time with a picture of quantum mechanics. If you're going to solve it, you're not going to solve it in some stupid way. You have to change some of the basic rules in an important fashion. And, well, it's very hard to modify quantum mechanics, and people have found it much easier to modify space-time. And it's very plausible that we're going to need an extension of our usual notions of space-time. The very best bet for it is supersymmetry, which involves new sorts of quantum mechanical dimensions. Supersymmetry would need a public talk all on its own. So, and perhaps you've heard a number, so I will be brief about this. But the idea is that in addition to our ordinary dimensions of space and time, there are additional dimensions which are like our dimensions of space and time, except the numbers that you would use to measure them aren't like ordinary numbers. Ordinary numbers satisfy the property that A times B is equal to B times A. But what you'd use to measure distances, whatever that means, in these quantum dimensions would satisfy the property that A times B is equal to negative B times A. A sort of thing that's not possible with ordinary numbers, but is possible with quantum mechanical numbers. Because of that funny property that A times B is negative B times A times A is equal to zero. And that means intuitively you can't take more than one step in this quantum dimension. You take two steps and you're dead. So that means that as if a particle wandering around here, every now and then it might choose to move in the quantum dimension. When it moves in the quantum dimension, its projection in our ordinary dimensions, its shadow, if you like, in our ordinary dimensions, is another particle with almost identical properties with a few detailed things different. Really one detailed thing, something we call its spin. It's not really important for the purpose of this talk. But it means that everything that we've seen has a double. The electron has a partner called the selectron. Okay? The photon has a partner called the photino. And really, the whole world is doubled, very much like putting together quantum mechanics and relativity. Relativity was our old extension of our notion of space-time, doubled the world to give us antimatter. This new extension is going to double the world again and give us superpartners to everything. Now, that's an entire talk in itself, but let me at least give you a cartoon of why this solves the problem of the violent quantum fluctuations. The whole idea here is that there's a complete symmetry between this quantum dimension world and our ordinary dimension. So let's take our famous box and make it smaller and smaller. These fluctuations are getting more and more violent. But at some point, the box gets small enough that you get to see these quantum dimensions. It happens when it's around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters big. And then something funny happens, because there has to be perfect symmetry between the quantum dimensions and the ordinary dimensions, but you can't fluctuate in the quantum dimensions. You can't take more than one step, never mind fluctuate like mad. So that means that the only way for there to be a symmetry between these two things is to not fluctuate in the ordinary dimensions either. And as you go to very short distances, all the fluctuations are gone. Okay? This is an extension of space-time that removes these violent quantum fluctuations. It needed to be an extension of space-time if it was going to solve this problem at a deep level, and it is an extension of space-time, and it solves this problem in a deep way. Now, how would we see this stuff at the LHC? Well, we collide protons together. The protons have quarks inside them, and every now and then you give them enough energy to pop off into the quantum dimensions. They would look like the superpartners of quarks, squarks, in the ordinary dimensions. And they unfortunately don't come out wearing name tags saying, I'm a squark. So they decay in around 10 to the minus 27 seconds, which is how long it takes light to travel the distance of around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. So they decay like that. And they can decay in many different ways. Here, one way it can decay is into a quark and the superpartner of the photon. So that squark would decay like that. This one could do something more complicated. It decays to a quark and the superpartner of another particle called the W. It's decays to a positron and a selectron. It's decays to an electron and a photino again. But the way I've drawn it, the bottom of all these set of decay chains involves this particle, which is the partner of the light particle, the photino. All these guys are, you can see in your detector, but these things are neutral, they're massive, they're neutral, they're very weakly interacting, and they completely escape the detector. You don't see them. There are some massive particles that are really predicted by the theory. This entire structure that you needed, this extension of space-time, all this wonderful stuff, really gives you something that sits there at the bottom. It's neutral. It's a lot like the photon, but it's massive. It escapes the detector. It hardly interacts with anything. And you know that it's there by its absence. You notice energy and momentum that's missing from your collision. Okay? So I'm telling you this story I haven't said anything about dark matter here, right? There's just this picture of these theoretical problems, quantum fluctuations of the vacuum, et cetera, et cetera. But this superstructure needs and has in it an object which is neutral, relatively massive, and very weakly interacting. Now, that turns out to be precisely what the cosmologists were begging us for. And the fact that what the cosmologists were begging us for is what we're giving them is known to us in the business as the WIMP miracle. Okay? Now, WIMP stands for weakly interacting massive particle, which is what the dark matter, which is what we now, many of us believe the dark matter should be. It's in contradistinction to MACHO, which was another now wrong idea for what it could be, which is a massive compact halo object. As you can see, our desire in particle physics to invent silly names for things didn't abate in the 60s, alas. But let me tell you what the miracle is. So let me give you the picture for where the stuff came from. Okay. So here is the idea. These guys, let's imagine these were the photino, right? They interact with us. They interact with us relatively feebly, but they do interact with us. The same old interactions are shared by us and them. That means very early, when the universe was very, very hot, you could make these guys in great abundance. And there was some process that would take the ordinary stuff, collide them into each other, and produce produce new stuff. Also, a reverse process that would take two of these particles, annihilate them back into ordinary particles. Okay. Now, as the universe cooled, what happens is that everything gets less and less energetic, and it becomes harder and harder for ordinary particles to have enough energy to make these new particles. Meanwhile, these dark matter particles have no difficulty still annihilating. So you would expect that the amount of them that you have left over is just getting less and less. They're annihilating, and it's harder and harder to make them again. One thing saves them. One thing saves them from complete annihilation. And that's the fact that the universe is actually expanding. So not only is the universe cooling, but it's expanding. And so once they get so dilute that it just takes them so long to run into each other that before they have, the universe has doubled in size, they're not going to find each other anymore, they're not going to annihilate anymore, you're going to be left with some tiny trace amount of it left over. Okay. So now this is a calculation you can do. It's a calculation the cosmologist could do and say, what properties would such a particle have to have in order for it to be the dark matter that's out there, to have enough of it left over to serve its function, to make the things go around the galaxies in the right way and so on. It turns out that the range of this interaction is exactly around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. That's precisely the place where, from these totally independent theoretical arguments, we expected new particles, new forces, new interactions with exactly this sort of range. This is a remarkable fact. It didn't have to happen. And it's a strong indirect evidence that we're on the right track. You know, purely internally, we believe there has to be all this extra stuff. And that does something in the other end of the spectrum of distances, which works. Let me give you an idea of just how much of this stuff is around. Okay, if they have a mass, so their mass would be order of hundreds of times the mass of the proton, and there would be, if this picture is correct, one of them in every liter of space here. Okay, so there's one of them there, it's one of them there, it's one of them there, and they're zipping around. Unfortunately, they're not right at rest. Well, a little fortunately. They're zipping around at around 1/1000th the speed of light. Okay, so whatever that is. I can't do it in my head, I'm sorry. 300 kilometers a second. Is that right? That's right, I guess. Yeah, 300 kilometers a second. They're zipping around at 300 kilometers a second. Okay. Now, so that's a quick introduction to what this stuff might be. And now let me tell you the strategies that people have devised for looking for them. Okay. The strategy actually takes that picture for something that had to happen to make them in the early universe to begin with, and interprets this picture with time running in different directions. Okay. So for example, what you can do is produce them at the LHC in the way that we just talked about a second ago. Right? You collide ordinary particles. So time would run in this direction. You collide ordinary particles, and you'd make dark matter particles. So we could do that at the LHC. It would show up as some energy missing. And in fact, the LHC could be a dark matter factory. This would just be awesome. We wouldn't have to, we could just make it in the laboratory on Earth and study its properties. It's not so easy because you can't trap them. But you try to study their properties indirectly. Now, you can do something else. I told you that you have a galaxy sitting there, and it's actually surrounded by this cloud of dark matter. The dark matter you should think of the galaxy as being surrounded by a halo of dark matter particles, and the halo is around 100 times bigger than the galaxy itself. Okay, so it's a gigantic halo of dark matter particles, and just because of gravity, the dark matter particles tend to clump more towards the center of the galaxy. So something you would expect is every now and then the same process of the dark matter particles annihilating should happen close to the center of the galaxy. And when that happens, they should spit out very high energy particles. Not only very high energy particles, but very high energy matter and antimatter. Because these guys are neutral. If they're going to make ordinary particles, they'll make matter and antimatter out of it. So there should be a source of very high energy antimatter headed at us from the center of the galaxy. And what you can do is put up satellites and other balloons and other things to look for antimatter from the center of the galaxy. That's called indirect detection. So you can make it directly, You can try to see it indirectly. And of course, if you really want to see that it's the dark matter that's actually out there, then really what you should do is try to interpret time going this way and have a process where the dark matter bangs into an ordinary particle and shakes the ordinary particle. So these are the so-called direct detection experiments, and they all work roughly like this. You have a big vat of heavy stuff. The vat of heavy stuff can be germanium, it can be sodium iodide, it can be xenon. You make it really, really cold. You put it in a really deep underground cavern to shield it from all sorts of other possible junk that could be coming from cosmic rays. So you try to make it as quiet and cold an environment as possible, and then you wait. Okay. You wait and you wait for one of these dark matter particles, one of these things, one of them every liter zipping around, to come and bang into the nucleus and just shake it. Okay. And it's sitting there with nothing else around. If you all of a sudden you see an awful lot of shaking going on in the middle of this detector, then it's evidence for something that's managed to penetrate a mountain, it's managed to penetrate all sorts of stuff, and bang into your detector. This is going to be the source of all of our excitement towards the end of the talk. So those are the strategies for looking for it. Okay, so now I want to tell you a little bit about, when did I start? Around 10 minutes after? All right. Oh, okay, great. All right. All right, this is just to emphasize that we have lots of evidence for dark matter from lots and lots of different scales. So it's not just that picture of the galactic rotation curves, but let me move on. So what I now want to tell you about is a suite of interesting hints that perhaps dark matter had been perhaps detected, which were the things that David alluded to, culminated in a number of interesting anomalies that were observed last summer that got a number of us excited about the possibility that maybe we were seeing indirectly the effects of dark matter. I want to emphasize that what I'm about to tell you about is a specific story. It's a story that I've been involved with my collaborators. It's by no means a consensus of any sort about what's going on. In fact, it's something while not quite on the chopping block tomorrow, it will certainly be watching very, very carefully. But mostly, I want to tell you about the story because it's a really fun detective story, and it gives you an idea of the kind of interaction between theory and experiment that's now happening. You know, it's not the sort of interaction that I've suffered through in my career so far for 15 years, where you make predictions, you write down models, you make predictions for an experiment that will happen in 15 years. It's now at the point where you make predictions and the experimentalists go back and they tell you 3 months later, they give you more data and you go back and forth and you fight and you doubt them and they doubt you. But it's really different. It feels different. It's psychologically different. It's wonderful. And even if everything that I'm telling you was wrong, in the sense of not actually being right, there are other senses. It's at least internally right. It'll give you a sense. It'll give you the sense for this kind of back and forth and the sort of excitement which is involved. Okay. In order to do it, I'm going to basically tell you a story of a whole sequence of experiments that for 10 years, basically almost all these experiments that I told you about, with the exception of CDMS, almost all the experiments that I was telling you about for the past 10 years who've been looking for dark matter have kind of seen something. They kind of seen something, and it's always been the sort of thing, it's like, it looks a little weird. It's the sort of thing that at some zeroth order, maybe roughly smells like dark matter, but never felt like it really fitted any of our preconceptions for what it might look like. And because of the interesting relation between theory and experiment that I told you about earlier, you don't believe a piece of experiment until you have a good theory for it, if you're a theorist. Okay. And so, you know, all these hints were there, they're lying around, people talked about them, but it was never taken, I think, very seriously, except by a number of people. who pursued it for a while. But these hints have been growing and growing and growing. And one of the things that got me interested in this business about a year ago is a psychological change where I started believing it, they might all be right. And that happened, at least for me, because of the realization that there might be a reasonable theoretical framework that would make sense of all of them, and which had many other interesting implications that will really be on the chopping block in the next year or so. And that's what I want to tell you about. But I'm going to begin my story really sequentially with the first of these experiments. Before telling you what the experiment is, let me tell you what the idea was. This was something that was looking for directly looking for dark matter. So one of these vats deep underground. It was with the sodium iodide. And this was using a rather clever observation that remember, you're looking for these dark matter particles to bang into all the time, right? But the Earth is going around the sun, and meanwhile, we're moving into this wind of WIMPs that are moving with a velocity around 10 to the minus 3. But in the summer, we're moving more into them, so there's more energy available for scattering. In the winter, there's less. So you'd expect to see, you put it deep underground, you do the best you can to shield it from various sources of contamination, but it's hard. It's hard to get rid of the contamination completely. You can have some radioactive junk lying around in your material. It's hard to get rid of everything completely, but it's very difficult to imagine something that would have a seasonal variation. Okay, so you look for this annual modulation, the seasonal variation, to try to confirm that what you're seeing is actually something associated with WIMPs. And by the way, I mean, there's a very specific prediction for when it should be at a peak. It should be at a peak on June 2nd. That's the day when this velocity is as big as possible. I forget when the trough is. Well, 6 months minus June 2nd. Okay. So let me come back to that. So the story begins in a deep underground cavern in Italy. Okay. Called Gran Sasso, where there's a bunch of experiments of this sort. And the experiment is the Dharma experiment. You don't need to pay any attention. I'm going to be showing you a lot of plots that look like this. Don't worry about any of the details. I want you to get the impressionistic idea that I'm not just making things up. But I'll try to. This is really a story. I want you to follow the thread of the narrative more than the details. Okay, so Dharma was looking for some seasonal annual modulation in something, in their signal. Never mind what it means exactly. This is what they got early on, some kind of modulation, and this is what they got, I think, last year. Okay, sure looks like there's some kind of seasonal modulation of something. And furthermore, while you can't see it here, the peak was exactly on June 2nd. They've been running for 8 years, every year, every 8 years, they see some seasonal variation, the peak is on June 2nd, exactly where it's supposed to be. David's complaining already. Okay, now, there was a reason why people didn't believe this experiment. And that's because it was apparently excluded by several orders of magnitude by other experiments that were looking for the same thing. So let me introduce you to one of these other experiments. Everything I'm introducing is going to have a role to play in this story. It's like a complicated Victorian novel. Okay. So this experiment, it's called Xenon. And it's the same idea over and over again. This is like a vat of liquid xenon. And what you do is you look for a dark matter particle, comes in, it bangs into the xenon, it shakes the xenon, and in a little more detail, it gives off some light, it gives off some electrons that drift up there that you measure. And none of these details matter very much, but essentially, by looking both for the light that comes out of it and the electrons that come out of it, you can distinguish what was a dark matter event from what was just some ordinary garden variety thing coming from some radioactive contamination that you couldn't have controlled. Okay. So the target nucleus here is xenon. That's okay. And well, this is what they're looking for. So there's some scatter plot of events. All these things appear from the trick I was telling you about before, you can identify as background, also known as garbage. Okay, you don't care about those things. And then xenon, they weren't looking. They had a what's known as a blind analysis. So they decided ahead of time what they were going to say, what would be signal, what were they going to say would be background, and they just opened up their box to see what they saw. And this was their signal region. And you see, well, they have a few events here and there. So that's kind of interesting. But what was really significant to them is that there was absolutely nothing here. See, this is totally empty there. And that really allowed them to mammothly exclude, by about a factor of 1,000, Dhamma's interpretation of what they saw, they thought. And this is because of a detailed reason I don't have time to explain, but you would expect from ordinary properties of dark matter that if you saw events here, you'd find way more here. So the fact that there was this big empty gap here just meant there was nothing there, really nothing there. And that's why they more or less decided these things were also probably garbage, and they found excuses for them, or they started making excuses for why they weren't signals. And in fact, experimentalists like to draw plots like this that tell you what they've been excluding. Again, you don't really need to understand the details here. This is a measure of how strongly the WIMP bangs into things. This is the mass of the WIMP. And here are the limits from the various experiments down here at very, very small values for how strongly interacting the WIMP is. All you need to know is that what you would take to explain Dhamma would be all the way up there. So when I say it's excluded, it's not like by a few. It's excluded by factors of 1,000. Okay. So that's one of the reasons why, even though there's this thing sitting there modulating away, people thought, okay, can't be real. That's something else. You know, summer vacations happen in the summer. All sorts of things modulate in the summer. Maybe it's something else. It has nothing to do with dark matter. Very good. All right. That's one of the anomalies. Then, last summer, something else happened. Remember, another thing that I told you might expect is some antimatter from the center of the galaxy. Some extra antimatter from the center of the galaxy. Very good. So, and there were some very weak hints that maybe there was some extra antimatter out there in satellites, but it was never big enough for anyone to write home about. Until this Italian satellite, Pamela, went up and measured positrons. And what it measured was the following curve. Again, you don't need to pay attention to the details, but it was plotting the ratio of the number of positrons it measured to the total number of electrons plus positrons. And this is a ratio that's falling, and you would naively expect it to fall. It's harder and harder to make antimatter at higher and higher energies, but then everyone went berserk when the actual experimental results showed it started rising again. Again, this is not something where there was some disagreement between theory and experiment. The curve should have looked like this rather than like that. It was a completely qualitative change in behavior. It went from falling to rising. Okay. This was sufficiently exciting that it was discussed at one of the international meetings in particle physics. So that's when I first heard about it. I wasn't actually there, but both of my co-organizers here, Neil Weiner and Doug Finkbeiner, who are really the real pioneers in this business, were there. And I got a text message from Neil saying that something very exciting was going on. And I immediately went online to try to find their talk. You know, that's the way things science is done these days. But they put everything in their talk except for that plot. Because they weren't ready yet. They knew it was going to be perhaps exciting, and they weren't quite ready yet. So that's okay. 2 weeks later, they also gave a talk at the meeting in Sweden. And this time, people were prepared with their cell phone cameras. Okay. So when this plot went up, this picture was taken by Neil and immediately emailed to me. So that's when I first saw the Pamela data. But anyway, the reason this is exciting is this is one of the things you expect to see. You expect to see an excess of antimatter over and above what you expect, and all of a sudden, there it is. There seems like an excess of antimatter. Okay, so that's the official plot from their eventual paper. that's kind of cool. Now, the plot further thickens. Back in May, the Fermi satellite, which is yet another satellite up there that's, whose real job in life is going to be to look for gamma rays from the center of the galaxy. And well, we'll talk about Fermi again in a second. But it starts to see a hint of an excess. And you know, so this is what they expect it to see. And then as they go to higher energies, they measure the total number of electrons and positrons. And they started seeing a hint of an excess up here, with the total mass being in the neighborhood of a few hundreds times the mass of the proton, exactly right around where you'd roughly expect dark matter particles to be. And furthermore, in much more detail, quite consistent with what Pamela was seeing. So this is a third thread. Okay? None of these things individually, and perhaps not even collectively, are convincing, but they're all little hints, little hints. Now, this is when a lot of the fun started, because us particle physicists were like, fantastic, we're going to try to interpret this as dark matter. And our astrophysics colleagues came along and said, whoa, we have no idea. You have no idea that it's dark matter. It could be astrophysics. That's when I learned that astrophysicists don't actually know what astrophysical objects do ahead of time. Okay? So astrophysics is really complicated. It's not their fault. At least as far as I know, it's not their fault. Astrophysics is really complicated, and it's possible to produce these very high energy matter and antimatter from ordinary things, like pulsars. In fact, as I've learned, pulsars can do anything. Okay? So I'm not joking. This could well be pulsars. In fact, the pictures are very different. You know, in the dark matter picture, these things are coming from the center of the galaxy. They concentrate near the galactic center. Here, they could be coming from some nearby pulsars. They're not coming from the center of the galaxy. These satellites have no idea the direction from which these positrons are coming, and it doesn't matter anyway, because these positrons get all curled up and messed around as they propagate from the center of the galaxy to here. So it's hard to know. So this was a wonderful fight between these two communities, very friendly fight. They say pulsars, 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 and well, we say it could well be pulsars, but maybe it's dark matter. So how might you decide between these two options? Well, the way to decide is to look at something which is harder to fake. And electrons and positrons have the difficulty that they get coiled around, and they have a complicated road from wherever they're made to where we see them here. But light does not. You make light at the center of the galaxy, it's going to come straight at you. Okay? So you should ask whether there's any hints involving funny signals with light. Okay? Now, many of you have probably seen this picture of the cosmic microwave background taken by the WMAP satellite. This is supposed to be about cosmology. It's a fantastic thing. We've learned a huge amount from it. But you've probably never seen it look like this disgusting mess. Okay? So what do you think this junky mess in the middle is? That's our galaxy. Okay? So when you see these nice maps, the galaxy has been, you know, has been nicely erased from it. Now, one of the people who helped erase the galaxy, or the sorts of people who help erase the galaxy, what do you have to do? You have to be extremely careful and try to understand all the different sources that could give you microwave radiation coming from the center of the galaxy. So one of my co-organizers, Doug Finkbeiner, was one of the world experts on the subject. In fact, he was an expert on the subject of what dust looks like. Very exciting subject. Okay. Dust, interstellar dust, what does not just dust, but something called spinning dust on top of it, which I barely know what dust is, and I don't even want to know what spinning dust is. Okay? But he was actually trying to figure out what the component of spinning dust was that would contribute to this microwave. Okay? And so what he did is try to understand and subtract all known sources. So there's lots of different sources for what could be producing these microwaves, and he made maps for every single one of them. He tried to measure them from the data, subtract them, just to see, well, you could just get rid of everything, right? Just get rid of everything, clean it up, and be left with nothing. That's what he was expecting to find. But he didn't find that he could get rid of everything. And what he found was that there was something persistent that was always sitting there, around the center of the galaxy. Okay? So this is literally what he saw. Maybe you don't think this is so exciting. Maybe it doesn't look so exciting, but to some of us looking at it, we're like, holy crap, there is light around the center of the galaxy. He called it the WMAP haze. Actually, it's kind of more striking down here in the, there's some junky thing blocking your view up there. But it's pretty striking down here. It extends quite a ways beneath the galactic plane. And what made it even more striking was the following observation that he made. If there is dark matter at the center of the galaxy, and if it's there with roughly the properties we expect it to have, and if it's annihilating into electrons and positrons, then those electrons and positrons will bend in the magnetic field of the galaxy. And when they bend, whenever any charged particle bends, it emits radiation. It turns out that the frequency of the radiation that would be emitted by such charged particles bending in the magnetic field is exactly in this frequency range. And not only that, the rough intensity, within a few orders of magnitude, the rough intensity is just about what you'd expect to see there. That's really what started making me excited. Not that there is this thing there, but again, that there is a very plausible theory for what it might be as well. This is not pulsars. Okay? That's one thing they can't make with pulsars. Oh, but someone told me they can. So they can really. Pulsars are amazing things. Now, if you really believe this, and this is something Doug emphasized back then, if you really believe this, then you would expect to also see the following thing. So he says there's some population of electrons and positrons screaming at us from the center of the galaxy. So they're coming at really high energies, right? They're coming from these dark matter particles that are annihilating. So what they should do every now and then is one of these really high energy electrons or positrons should bang into starlight. Now what happens when a really fast thing bangs into a slow thing? Or a less energetic thing. It's light, so it's moving at the speed of light. It's not slow. Well, basically, it transfers all of its energy. So it's like you have this really very high energy electron coming out of banging into starlight, and now you have a very high energy photon going out. So if this picture was correct, as Doug emphasized, you would expect to see from the center of the galaxy also a deviation and more photons at much, much higher energies. These microwaves are at really, really low energies, but at much, much high energies, comparable roughly to the masses of the dark matter particles, so tens times the mass of the proton, hundreds of the mass of the proton in that vicinity, you should start to expect to see some excess in gamma rays from the center of the galaxy. Now, this Fermi satellite that just went up in May, back in August, released its photon data from the center of the galaxy. And Doug and friends did a first analysis. Now, this is a wonderful thing about the way this field works. These experimentalists have done all this amazing hard work. They've collected all this data, but they actually released it. And so a theorist like Doug could pick it up and actually do an analysis. Just look at it. And what he found was evidence for another haze, the Fermi haze. So once again, taking out all the stuff you expect to see and subtracting it all out, you're left with something. Okay. Looked an awful lot like the WMAP haze, but now at way higher energies, exactly in the energy range you would expect. And if you modeled it with something that looked like that, a little too egg-shaped for dark matter perhaps, you might expect dark matter to give you a slightly more spherical shape. So that's a little funny. But still, if you model it, it matches things quite beautifully. So this was a qualitative prediction, and it's even a somewhat quantitative prediction from this picture that, again, seems to be holding together, just as expected. I should say, this is not sanctioned by the Fermi collaboration. They're doing their own analysis of this and trying to understand it. And I can't emphasize this enough times, okay? Every one of these things could be standard astrophysics or just wrong. I'm telling you the story in a particular way, in the way that serves my purposes, and in the way that I've used as motivation for thinking about what might be going on. So there was this whole collection of possible hints, and what got me excited was the realization that there was a fairly simple picture, perfectly plausible picture as from the point of view of a particle physicist that actually could simultaneously explain all of them. and also some other things that I haven't had a chance to tell you about. Okay. So we claimed last October that all of these anomalies are actually a consequence of a simple assumption that the dark universe does not simply consist of a single particle. But there's actually a little dark world there. Okay? The dark matter is also affected by its own forces. There's particles that it interacts with, not feebly. There's a whole dark world. It doesn't have to be horrendously complicated, but there needs to be a dark force, specifically. There's got to be a force that affects the dark matter particle, and the range of that interaction is around 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. Now, I have no time to explain all of this, but this funny number, 10 to the minus 14 centimeters, all these things turn out to be a natural consequence of supersymmetry. Again, that same thing that we as theorists love to hang on to over and over again. And this is all associated with a picture of the world that I will just flash quickly here, which I think is many people had talked about off and on, but these ideas have really forcefully brought to the fore to at least take seriously. That while the development in fundamental physics in the last 60 years has been in this direction, you work harder and harder, you go to shorter and shorter distances, maybe up here we'll discover some grand concepts like supersymmetry, that what we might just starting to be seeing is a whole orthogonal direction in which this development can happen, where we don't actually, it's not necessarily associated with going to shorter and shorter distances or higher and higher energies, but the discovery of nearby sectors. Nearby dark sectors that are not so ridiculously weakly coupled to us that we can't tell that they're there and learn something about them. And in fact, this dark world out here could have to have supersymmetry down at these much larger distances. So we could explore all of this physics not by building more and more gigantic accelerators, but by doing completely different sorts of experiments aimed at going sideways rather than going up in this picture. Okay, so I'll only take a few minutes to describe how this idea works. So really, you can imagine that the dark matter has its own kind of interaction, just like electrons and photons couple to each other, the dark matter and some dark photon couple to each other. There's a range of the interaction, which is roughly 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. And how does the dark photon couple to our world? It couples just like an ordinary photon does, but the strength of its interaction is weaker by about a factor of 1,000. Again, these funny numbers are not put in by hand. They're a natural consequence of a theoretical structure that I don't have more time to talk about. So what we're doing is positing not new very heavy particles, which is what we normally do in theoretical physics, but quite light particles. You know, we've been to these distances for 60 years. But we're saying there's some particles lying around there that couple to us with a strength just 1,000 times weaker than ordinary things. Really amazingly, and this is, I think, one of the most wonderful things that's come out of at least thinking about this, even if it's all wrong, is the realization that this is allowed. Even though we've been doing experiments for 60 years and we've collided hundreds of billions of protons together and electrons together, and we've done all these incredible precision experiments, it's possible to have an entire world next door coupled to us only 1,000 times more weakly than we're coupled to each other and not have known it so far. Okay? It's rather extraordinary. So it's really allowed by all current experiments. And as I've kept emphasizing, there could be, even though we've gone past here for 60 years, down right here at these masses could be this whole supersymmetric world. All these things that we want to understand about this deep new symmetry of space-time could be sitting there, not at very short distances, but sideways, right next to us. I don't have time to explain how this picture in detail lets you understand all of these anomalies. I'll just flash some cartoons. For example, the dark matter particles, when they annihilate, actually annihilate much more effectively because they have this relatively long-range force, relatively speaking, 10 to the minus 14 centimeters being much longer than 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. They have this relatively long-range force sucking them in and giving them an enhanced annihilation rate into electrons and positrons. That's one of the things that ends up being needed, which is hard to do in the more standard supersymmetric picture. You see, this is another supersymmetric picture of the world, but it's more Baroque. It's more profligate in new stuff. It isn't just a single particle, there's a whole little sector next door. And what it's doing is a number of things in detail which were just hard to accommodate, all the funny anomalies that I told you about. Remember, I told you none of them really smelled right in the usual picture, even roughly. And this one addition, the one addition of this extra force, made everything makes all of a sudden start making sense. So they would annihilate very effectively, they would annihilate into dark stuff, but the dark stuff was so light that they could only decay back to electrons and positrons. And this qualitatively and quantitatively could explain all the anomalies. It could also explain why it was that that Dhamma, that modulation experiment, saw something while the other experiments did not. And it's due to a peculiar property of how forces work between neutral particles, something which would take a little too long to explain, but the force actually does not leave the nature of the dark matter particle intact. It changes it from one kind to another kind, which is very, very slightly heavier, with a very tiny energy splitting between them. And this is not a choice. This is just the way the laws of quantum field theory work. So there's absolutely no choice but for this collision not to be what you'd call in high school an ordinary elastic collision, but instead to need some minimum velocity in order to be able to have enough energy to produce this excited state and therefore be an inelastic collision. And as first realized by my other co-organizer, Neil Weiner, and Dave Smith, almost 8 years ago, this radically changes the analysis of the Dhamma data and makes it possible for Dhamma to be seeing something while the other experiments were not. In fact, if we go back to this experiment that badly ruled out Dhamma, remember, it was ruled out because they made the assumption that there should be a huge amount of events here. But in this picture, that wouldn't be the case. In this picture, you need a certain minimum amount of velocity of kinetic energy to even have a chance of making this slightly heavier excited state. And this picture would actually predict ahead of time, that you'd see a gap, and then you'd start seeing events. And that's what they saw. Okay? And in fact, there's been back and forth with the experimentalists, have done a reanalysis with this interpretation in mind, and some interesting things are starting to come out of that. So this pattern is really, this is not a joke, this is really the pattern that's expected from dark force scattering. And it's conceivable that some of what they thought was background in their usual interpretation is actually signal from this new interpretation. Okay, so those were motivations, but there's actually a number of smoking guns. And what I mean by smoking gun is a number of results that, if they're confirmed, would almost completely verify this picture. That's the sort of thing that's always wonderful to have. It's also wonderful to have things that would completely disprove it. Okay? These are extremes. These are extremes. We don't always get them in the way physics develops. In this case, we happen to have some examples of both, which I will tell you about. So first, let me tell you about the smoking guns. One smoking gun coming from looking at the galaxy is the following. So I told you you should have all these extra gamma rays coming from the center of the galaxy because the dark matter particles pile up there. Okay? Now it turns out that the people who put gazillions of dark matter particles together on a computer and let them interact with Newton's laws of gravity, just to simulate what these halos would look like around the galaxy, they made an interesting discovery. They discovered that the dark matter wasn't completely uniformly distributed, but in places it got more clumpy. And those places had nothing to do with where the galaxy was. It was just, 30 degrees off the galactic plane somewhere. Okay? But that's a second place where there's an opportunity to see lots of gamma rays. And this time, there is no possible confusion from things in the center of the galaxy. If you see that region of the sky, 30 degrees off the galactic plane, lighting up in gamma rays, it's very hard to believe that it's coming from anything other than some new kind of particle that's annihilating into light somehow, right? In fact, you would start using this as a way of tracing where they are. It should really literally be seeing them with light indirectly because they're annihilating into stuff that then gives off light, but you'd really start seeing them and tracing what their density distribution looks like. So here's a simulation run by one of the members in our program who gave a wonderful talk on this subject 2 days ago here, of what these so-called subhalos would look like in this theory. And, you know, on the 1 to 5 year time scale, this is what the sky should look like. It should have these freckles away from the galactic plane, just lighting up. If this is what these maps look like in 5 years, we've seen annihilating dark matter. And I think there it's just very hard to come up with any other interpretation for what's going on, even though it's indirect. And some of this data will be collected within the time scale of a year, but this kind of very detailed picture will actually emerge on the 5 year time scale. Now, there is something that Neil and Doug and I and Tracy Slatcher and a number of other people are waiting for really anxiously, which is both a smoking gun and something that would completely kill as well simultaneously. The interpretation I told you for inelastic scattering that would explain why Dhamma saw something while nothing else did. Okay. So there's an experiment, the next generation of that xenon experiment, still at Gran Sasso. The first generation with xenon 10, this is xenon 100 with 100 kilograms of xenon. And this is just running now. In fact, the speaker at our meeting told us that as of Friday, they would actually start doing their dark matter run. If this theory that we're talking about is correct, they should have hundreds of events by April. Okay? And at least if the part of the theory that explains why Dhamma saw something with a, if that part is right, they should have hundreds of events. If they do not have hundreds of events in April, the theory is wrong. Full stop. Okay? If they have hundreds of events, the theory is very likely right. Okay? And it's a remarkable experiment with effectively zero background. So this we should know by mid-2010. Now, this whole picture, a new global picture of the world that's associated with this, that there are all these sectors lying around with light particles that we don't have to build gigantic accelerators to see. We can see them with much lower energy experiments. What kind of experiments would you use? Well, you don't need very high energies. In fact, it hurts to have high energies. You want low energies because you want to be able to produce these particles effectively. But what you need is lots of current, big intensity, because these couplings are relatively weak. To us, are relatively weak. So the sort of experiment you do is to get a slab of material, a little hunk of lead, maybe a millimeter thick, and you just lay as big a current into it as you possibly can. And what happens is that in the material, they interact to produce a dark photon. And the dark photon can either in the material or exit the material and decay into ordinary particles whose properties you can measure. Okay. And there's many, many experiments of this sort. Actually, there are some analyses that are being done on data that has already been collected and was sitting on tape from experiments that are officially over. Okay. But who had not looked for this, who had not looked for anything like this. And so that analysis is being done now by our friends at SLAC and at Cornell and other places. Okay. But there's also proposals for new experiments. There was a workshop at Stanford back in September, and there was a large number of experimental groups looking to get involved. I think it's quite likely that a new set of experiments will actually be done that really directly checks this idea. Okay. And these experiments, I think, via time scale, is on the order of a year. Okay. Finally, there are smoking guns at the LHC for this idea. This will take me too long to explain, but it's possible to very effectively populate this dark sector by producing new particles at the LHC, ordinary supersymmetric particles at the LHC. In fact, the particles that we would in the ordinary picture call the dark matter. In the ordinary supersymmetric picture, we'd call these photinos the dark matter. But in this picture, they can decay into the dark sector. And those decay products will eventually decay back into the standard model, into ordinary particles, electrons and positrons. And because the things in this dark world are so much lighter than the things in our world, when a photino in our world, 100 times heavier than the proton, decays into them, they're moving really fast. And because they're moving really fast, when they decay back into our stuff, those decay products are also moving really fast. But everything is really, really collimated in very, very narrow cones. So you'd expect to see events that are crazy otherwise, from the point of view of ordinary particle physics experiments, where you get beams or jets with very tiny opening angles, but which contain tons of ordinary particles. Okay? This is a real striking smoking gun of this entire picture, and is a sort of thing which you would really expect to see at the LHC if this picture is right. See, that's why I wanted to tell you this story. So you can see it connects, it's possible that this era of data is going to connect things going on in the center of the galaxy with things going on kilometers underground with things going on at the LHC, and that there is a thread that could conceivably connect all of them. Okay. This is what one of those events would look like at the LHC, but anyway, I don't have time to explain it. So let's end by talking about what the real excitement is going to be with CDMS. So here's a cartoon of what CDMS looks like. I couldn't find a particularly nice picture of it online. I'm sorry. But anyway, it's again one of these direct detection experiments. The dark matter particle comes along. The nucleus is made of germanium. It bangs into the germanium. The dark matter goes out, and you try to measure the kick of the germanium nucleus. Okay, it's 50 millikelvin, incredibly cold, sitting there in the deep underground mine in northern Minnesota somewhere. Very appropriate, lonely place. Okay. As I said before, CDMS is the granddaddy of all dark matter detection experiments, and it's been steadily improving limits for over a decade. I say this because they have never cried wolf. They've never said, we've seen something. No, we haven't seen something. The very last time they released their data, they did this thing. They opened the box. They saw what there was. They decided ahead of time what they would count as something real, what they would count as something as a background. And this is what they saw. And this is the sort of thing they've seen over and over again. You don't need to pay any attention. Don't worry about the top. You don't even need to really understand what the axis is. Well, let me tell you, this axis is measuring at least the recoil energy of the nucleus. That's what you try to measure. Never mind what that is. But between the red bands is where they would have expected to see events if there was dark matter, and they didn't see one event. Okay? So they're not screwing around. They're not constantly seeing things and then taking it back. Their last analysis, they had nothing. No events. Okay? They now have four times more data. And I have no idea what they're seeing, and it's driving us all completely bonkers. Okay? And they've kept an incredible poker face about it. Not even David managed to extract it from them. Or if he has, he didn't tell us. So what I want to just do, it'll just take a few minutes, is we can't help but imagine what they might be seeing, right? So I just want to show you just some pictures of what, I mean, they're going to show us tomorrow a picture that looks just like this, except there'll be some X's in here somewhere. Okay? And I just want to show you what some of those X's would look like and how I'd feel. Right? Keep in mind, because they had no events here, they can't have 100 events when they open up their new box. Okay? In fact, zero events, when an experiment says they have zero events, it's really consistent with having half an event or one event. There's some official statistical measure for this, but let's just call it half an event is perfectly okay. The fact that they saw nothing before is reasonably consistent with the idea that they may be seeing now, with more data, three or four events. I'd be surprised if they're seeing six. I'd be thrilled if they're seeing five, very happy if they're seeing four, and quite pleased if they're seeing three. Okay? So I'm going to assume they're seeing three, and let me just plot them in various places. Just so you know, as David said, things have been lots of fun, and the biggest topic of discussion is where these three events are going to be. There's even a betting pool. You're free to join. You'll probably do as well as we do. Okay? Only $5. All right, so scenario number one. I put an extra event there just because I couldn't help it. Okay. Let's say all their events are piled up here. Then Neil has a heart attack. Okay? This is exactly what you would expect while it was hard for him to predict the number of events from the inelastic picture of dark matter, if you were going to see them at all at CDMS, which was not obvious for reasons I don't have time to explain, if you're going to see them at all, they'd all have to be piled up at high, relatively high recoil energies. And the reason for that, you don't have to understand the details to see it, the reason was in this whole picture, everything had to be moving more quickly in order to have enough energy to make this inelastic scattering happen. So if there are three events and they're all piled up at 60 keV, and if they're all in the summer on top of it, if they all happen in the summer on top of it, that's it. Okay, I think there are many reasons we suspect this is not what they're seeing. Many reasons we suspect this is not what they're seeing, which I don't have time to go into. But in any case, if this is what they were seeing, that this would be inelastic jubilation. Okay. Here is something. This is my bet in the betting pool. Okay, that they're seeing something like that. Now this would be fascinating, because this smells very, very much like what you'd expect in a completely standard supersymmetric picture of the world. The very first thing that I told you about, okay? And this would not be consistent with it being exactly the same species of particle of the sort I was giving you this whole story about earlier, right? You know, all this anomaly and the haze and this and that, and that entire picture seemed at least to us to suggest this richer structure. That thing literally, in and of itself, does not appear to be this, if this is what they see. It doesn't mean that it's wrong. There could be, it's three events for one thing. It's there could be a more complicated picture with the two kinds of dark matter particle. You know, everything we've learned about the structure of at least the particles that make up our worlds, that they don't look particularly simple and economical in how they're and what they look like. The principle and the laws are shockingly simple and economically, but the actual particles don't look particularly special or nice in any way. So this is not unlike the thing I told you about xenon, which is really a chopping block. You know, if they don't see anything, the theory is dead. This does not mean that the story that I've been telling you about so far is dead, but it tells you to be very excited about something completely different. Okay. And furthermore, it smells very standard, very reasonable, very perfectly, totally reasonable. This would be extremely exciting. The first would be extremely exciting. This would be extremely exciting. That that would send us all back to the drawing board. If they saw that, I would believe the experiment is wrong before I believed any theory that explained that. Okay. Right. But that's just an example. Those are. And it gives you a sense for what three measly events can do to 60 people for 2 weeks, okay? In an era where there's a lot going on, okay? So two or three events can make a big, big difference. You can be happy, you can be sad, all based on what these guys who've sat down, you know, thousands of feet in some mine in northern Minnesota are going to give us. So all eyes now, after this announcement tomorrow, are going to turn to xenon 100 back in Italy. And this is the sort of thing that they might see by mid-2010. I'm basically copying the same kind of picture from the xenon experiment before. It won't look exactly like this, but just so you have an idea of the kind of plots that they might be showing. Okay. By April, I'm just repeating what I said before, but if this picture we have for what might explain Dhamma with all these forces, dark forces and everything is right, there should be 50 events sitting in there and no background. This is a complete slam dunk. It's a smoking cannon. Okay? It's not a smoking gun. Okay? On the other hand, let's say it's this picture for CDMS, right? This the thing that smells like vanilla is possible, supersymmetric picture of the world, wonderful. Then, again, by April, they should have 10 events sitting in there. 10 is a lot more than 3. Okay? And it's a real direct connection. Okay? If they don't see 10 events in there in April, then CDMS was wrong. So information is now coming rapidly. I really think by April now, hopefully we can, they'll have more fire in their belly and they'll get something to us by February. But but it's but certainly by April or May we should have some really striking confirming evidence. So I'm sorry I've gone so far over time, but I'll just repeat what David said. Please stay tuned to this story and read the New York Times on Friday. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, that was a great lecture, and I'm sure it gave you a feeling as to how theorists behave and what the excitement's all about. And as always, you know, we have great questions, and I don't want to stop the questions. It's getting kind of late, and we have, as usual, refreshments, and you can ask questions afterwards. But let's have some, and I hope there's somebody with a mic back there. Somebody have a mic? You could yell, but we left the recording. Where's our mic? Where's Kevin? Sorry? Okay, I can start here. Sorry, can you find the mic?
Is there a good internet address for this?
Well, their talk tomorrow is being live streamed on their website. If you just Google CDMS, dark matter. I made the mistake of just Googling CDMS, and there was some other company. CDMS stands for something else too. But if you Google CDMS dark matter, you'll get their website. I think it's CDMS dot something. But it'll be streamed on the talk will be streamed on their website tomorrow.
That was just wonderful. There's just one really basic thing I didn't get, which may mean I missed the whole point. But what exactly do you mean about going sideways at 10 to the minus 14th?
I was being slightly metaphorical. I just meant that the dominant sort of experiment we've been doing in this business since the 50s is to build bigger and bigger accelerators to go to shorter and shorter distances. There's a good reason for it, because the deepest truths are at the shortest distances. It's life, it's expensive, but it's worth it. However, what we're really after, the reason we're doing it isn't so much that we care about discovering 14 new particles. We're interested in important concepts, like supersymmetry, perhaps. And what this picture suggests is that it's possible that the same concepts are sitting next door to us, not at very, very tiny distances, at relatively large distances, at relatively low energies. But the reason we haven't noticed them isn't because we didn't build a high enough energy accelerator, it's because they're kind of weakly interacting with us.
I see. So that was what
right.
you meant about higher
That's what
currents.
I meant. Right, exactly.
The higher so, currents.
Exactly. You need higher currents in order to probe them, but not higher energies.
Got
right.
CDMS.
It's got to be, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, thank you. The website is cdms.berkeley.edu.
Hi, fabulous talk. So early on, you showed an image of the galaxy and said that prediction would indicate that it would the curve would accelerate, but instead it becomes a constant.
Right.
And then you
the curve would go down, and then it says goes to a constant.
And then you also
right.
said that we could think of dark matter as being a halo, and I didn't understand why, if that's the case, it's all coming from the center of the galaxy.
Oh, it isn't.
That's related to the...
That's the whole point. That's in fact the whole point. If all you had was a luminous matter, then you'd be stuck, because then the velocity really should go down. But because there's this big halo of dark matter extending well beyond the size of the galaxy... Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Was that the question? Oh, so just the gravitational self... interactions of the dark matter alone cause it to clump somewhat more in the center of the galaxy. But it does extend well beyond the size of the galaxy, so that the integrated thing can be made to match what the curve looks like.
Yes, remember in the early 50s when particles were burgeoning, and I.I. Robbie said, "Who ordered this?"
Mm-hmm.
And really, the trend afterward with Gell-Mann was simplification. The invention of quarks made sense of those 100 different particles. And I just wanted to, dark matter is, but can you see a deeper reason for its existence?
That's what I was trying. That's what I was trying to motivate in the somewhat long-winded first part of my talk. Was in fact I was trying to motivate it so strongly as to not to say the word dark matter, mention some quite deep theoretical problems that we have to solve. The question of why there is a macroscopic universe at all, that question. Mm-hmm. The question involving taming these violent quantum fluctuations in the vacuum. That's a question, just a purely theoretical question. You could not look out of the galaxy, not look at the world, contemplate that question and try to come up with a solution to it. The solution to that question has built into it, kind of as a side consequence. It's not, you know, from the point of view, from this more fundamental point of view, this is not the be-all and end-all of this theory that it produces a dark matter particle. It's some side consequence of this big structure, which is involved. Nonetheless, that side structure happens to be precisely what's needed to constitute the dark matter of the universe. That's the kind of connection between seemingly completely unrelated things that, when it happens, you try to take seriously. I should say that this idea of a WIMP has been the theorist's favorite idea for what the dark matter might be for 30 years, but there have always been other possibilities. I think one of the most striking things that will happen if we really see a WIMP, forget about this more detailed question about whether it's this kind or that kind or there are forces or not, is that this basic theoretical argument will have been proven to be right. And I think that'll be a very powerful hint that we're doing something right.
Thank you.
On this question of why there should be a macroscopic universe.
Yes.
Did I understand you correctly that you said, that this requires combination of quantum mechanics and relativity theory?
Yes.
From my experience, I know that everybody who knows quantum mechanics will understand it, that there are circumstances where you can understand the existence of a macroscopic universe with quantum mechanics.
Yes, right.
And can you clarify that?
Yeah, so this is, of course, the stability and existence of atoms, the fact that elephants are big is not a deep mystery. We understand how if you have large numbers and you input large numbers by hand into a system, you have many, many particles, you have the exclusion principle. We understand how to make large objects that are supported, macroscopic in that sense. The real problem here is that it isn't macroscopic stuff; it's macroscopic correlations in the vacuum, there is no solution of that sort, that of the usual sort that anyone has ever been able to come up with. Maybe there is a solution like that, but in the 30 years people have thought about it, the only idea that comes up over and over again, and I must say. Many other ideas have been had that at first seemed very different, but ended up being the same, essentially being the same. One way or another, there's some modification to the picture of space-time at short distances. I mentioned supersymmetry. There's also the idea of extra dimensions. Supersymmetry is a much, much deeper idea. I think it's not just more likely to be right, it's also a much deeper idea, so which is why I emphasized it. I'm afraid I didn't answer your question, but maybe I could try again later. Yes. Absolutely. That's one of the ways that when I mentioned that experimentalists are looking for the stuff in data on tape, that's one of the things that they're looking for. People have collided electrons and positrons at low energies for a long time, but they don't see it because you have to really know that you're looking for it, and they had really not looked for it. The first paper on this sort of analysis came out. Back in November, and there's many other analyses coming down the pipeline.
I'm sure everybody's stomach is empty, so I'll ask the question. You were very excited by 6543, but you failed to mention zero. So if CDMS announces zero, will you take antidepressants, or will you tweak the theory?
If CDMS announces zero events, certain members of the CDMS collaboration will not exit the room alive. CDMS will not have zero events.
We've concluded by deep psychological analysis that that is impossible.
We'll see. Yeah, we'll see.
Okay.
Well,
they're going to talk at 2. I bet you the announcement will be 2:50.
Yeah.
I think it's Pacific time.
Yeah.
Okay.
The announcement will be in the last 5 minutes of the talk. The first 45 minutes will be, we're great. We know what we're doing. It's the same thing you've heard forever, and it'll be in the last 3 transparencies. It is not in the style either of our subject or this collaboration to say rah 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 we're done. So I'd be very surprised if they do that. They're very serious, responsible people, so they will not do that. But it'll be in the last 5-10 minutes of the talk.
If you want to join the betting pool, there is a betting pool, $5 entry.
Yeah, I can tell you the rules.
Rules are what you guess the number of events.
You have to guess the number of events.
And the energy.
And the energies, right, exactly. You guess the number of events and the energies, and the payout works as follows. If you guess the number of events right, and if you do, the amount of money you get depends on how close your guess was.
I noticed Nima had 3 entries.
Yeah. So one of them was the second one was my guess. So.
But you're allowed more than one entry.
Huh? Oh, no. Oh, sorry. Right. No, the second one was my official entry for the betting pool. Yeah.
Okay. So let's thank Nima again for a wonderful talk. And as usual, the refreshments in the commons room.
Fantastic.